particularly the lengthy reign you gave me in Labor Party history. It reminded me a bit of an introduction I had recently when I went to speak in Noosa at a legal conference. And a very nervous chairman of, unlike yourself, a very nervous chairman of the gathering got up and said, I now want to introduce our special guest to address us. Elected to Parliament in 1945, he joined the Labor Party front bench in 1949 and left it in 1951, re-emerged on the front bench of the Labor Party in 1961, having attended the coronation of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. He then attended the Commonwealth Conference in Ghana in 1964, and became Minister for Education in the Whitlam government from 1972 to 1975. I thought, that's pretty spectacular. I got up and said, oh, I'm looking for Dad, but I don't see him here. Dad, as I recollect, contested the leadership of the Labor Party about 1966, but was an ignominious failure on that occasion, though he did well later on. Anyway, thank you for all attending here. I should acknowledge the fact that we have spread around the room a large number of members of the Alternative Government of Australia and candidates for office, and they're making a particularly fine effort to elect the Labor interest here in South Australia a couple of weeks from now. It has always been Labor that has believed in South Australia's economic potential. It was a Federal Labor government that established the automotive industry in this state. It was a Federal Labor government that invested in South Australia's defence industry. It is Labor that understands South Australian industry and Labor that can provide this state with a brighter economic future. At 10.4%, South Australia has the highest unemployment rate of any mainland state. Youth unemployment is now endemic at 36.6%, having risen 6.9 percentage points in the last couple of months. Recent ABS figures estimate that 9% of working people have been retrenched in the past 3 years alone. Yesterday's long-term unemployment figures are an indictment of this government. Long-term unemployment rose 7,500 last month. It rose 17,500 the month before that, the highest rise ever recorded in a year. Long-term unemployment has now risen 23,100 since the government introduced its failed job network, and by 52,300 since this government cut the $1.8 billion from Labor's job programs in May 1996. It ought to be contemplated that all these dreadful figures are actually being produced not in the context of a worldwide recession, but in the context of still some remnants of the growth that was there before this government came into office, when John Howard revealed to international bankers that he inherited an economy better than good in parts. Despite that growth, there has been only a job growth of some 300,000 since this government came in, compared with near 650,000 in the equivalent period in the time of the last government, and the majority of that growth has been in part-time unemployment, which, in defence of his job network the other day, the Employment Minister, Dr Kemp, described as not real jobs. South Australia is losing its industrial base, and it needs action to halt the decline. We believe we fail our duty to the nation if we allow any part of Australia to fall behind. South Australia's industrial and scientific successes have made Australia strong. Therefore, the nation needs to keep South Australia strong. This is why Labor has developed an action plan to build on the strengths of South Australian industry and create a better future for the state. There are two states which are the subject directly of action plans by this government. We have developed, of course, regional policies for vast numbers of areas around Australia. Regions in Australia are collapsing, and it is necessary to have effective regional policy to deal with that. However, there comes a point of time where a national interest factor enters into the deliberations about what is happening not just in a region, part of a region of a state or part of a state, but what is happening in the state overall. And what is happening now in Tasmania and South Australia is wrong for the nation, and therefore must be systematically addressed by the nation. We want to build on and develop here a vibrant industrial base. As a first priority in that regard, we will build on the existing South Australian Centre for Manufacturing by providing $24 million to create a Centre for Industry. This new Centre for Industry will add a strong services focus to the current Centre for Manufacturing to build all South Australia's industries, retain jobs and upgrade skills, apply new technologies and processes, and develop new products and markets. Together, the two centres will be backed up by Labor's industry policies, which contain significant benefits for South Australian industry, including a 150% tax concession for business research and development. Probably there are no two states in Australia that would benefit more from this particular initiative than South Australia and my home state, Western Australia, where there is at least so much interesting value-added industry out there, so much spin-off from what has already been done, that 150% tax concession offers some very real opportunities. Initiative to attract venture capital to develop South Australian industries, and a development allowance to encourage $5 billion of industrial investments. Labor will provide also $48 million in the first term of a Beazley Labor government to establish a new molecular biology research institute in Adelaide and secure it for the future out of the Telstra Award Fund. This institute is intended to cement Australia's leadership in the global race to develop and apply genetic technologies. We want to make sure we secure ownership of the intellectual property in this important emerging industry. The Institute will perform innovative basic research, provide important training for young research staff, and build job opportunities in South Australian industry, the sorts of opportunities which would be able to make massive use of that R&D tax concession that I referred to a bit earlier. I mean, just as we've had to be educated over the last few years in the industrial revolution which has spun off the back of the development of information technologies in the 1980s, the next great surge in industrial development building off a sea change in the scientific base, or the global scientific base, is going to occur in the molecular biology area. There are enormous spin-offs in food production, in agriculture, in health, a whole range of activities in which Australia has had some record of success, but little record of effective development beyond the research phase. Labor will also leverage South Australia's strong defence industry to provide jobs for the future. Defence contributes as much to South Australia's gross state product as the wine industry, about 4%. And employs directly or indirectly 19,000 people. Instead of selling Australian Defence Industries and the Australian Submarine Corporation, we will combine them into the one venture to build a new majority Australian-owned defence industry venture, government participation to be used as a nucleus for the building of that majority Australian-owned participation, and that will be headquartered here in Adelaide. We believe this combined body will have the critical mass to compete in an international environment increasingly dominated by large organisations. The government simply wants to sell off ADI. We want to use it to leverage in a very strong Australian defence industry. We are committed to building a further two Collins-class submarines for the Australian Navy. We do this for both strategic and economic reasons. The submarines will be an important strategic contribution to our defence in an increasingly militarised region, a region which we'll anticipate will go on to that further militarisation once its economic troubles have subsided. And these mean jobs and economic growth for Australia in general and South Australia in particular. Labor is committed to the success of arguably the world's best wine-producing area. arguably I say, as I would argue it from the southern parts of Western Australia, but others tell me I'm not allowed to argue that way. But anyway, arguably it's the world's best wine-producing area. We will spend $13 million over 3 years on scholarships to attend the International College of Hotel Management in South Australia and to boost the college's resources. We will commit $12 million to the National Wine Centre proposed for Adelaide as an important link between the wine and tourism industries in the state, two industries with great promise for South Australia's future. And we will continue the current taxation regime for the wine industry in contrast to the Coalition's proposals for a GST, which will increase the price of bottled and cask wine. Labor will make a substantial new investment in rail for South Australia. We will match the Howard Government's commitment of $100 million in our first term for the Adelaide to Darwin White Railway. We will also provide up to an additional $200 million, if necessary, after that, to ensure this important piece of national infrastructure goes ahead. Many argue for this rail from a point of view of the commercial needs of it. I don't know whether it's a commercial prospect or not. People tell me that it is. I do know, however, that there is a defence necessity associated with it, and I have always been committed to the view that it ought to go ahead for those reasons alone. Labor will also invest an additional $150 million over 3 years in rail across Australia, with a first priority being the upgrade of the Adelaide to Melbourne railway link. Labor believes in improving services to the South Australian community. We will allocate $7 million to purchase Glenthorne Farm from the CSIRO and grant it to the people of South Australia for public use, ensuring it is not handed over for private development, adding to Adelaide's urban sprawl. Labor will spend up to $12 million preserving and upgrading the Torrens Parade Ground site as a permanent annex to the Australian War Memorial. In so doing, we hope to make available the parade ground for the enjoyment of all South Australians, as well as displaying important items of South Australia's military history currently unavailable to the public. I'm not sure whether people are well aware of this, but the War Memorial in Canberra has in fact got more interesting things in storage than it has on display. And there is a real opportunity here, I do believe, to develop an effective annex here, which would be very useful both for the interest of South Australians, but probably more particularly for the interest of the many who are tourists in militaria and military history. I mean, the War Memorial in Canberra is one of the things which makes Canberra one of the most prominent tourist destinations in this country. And this would be, I think, a very useful addition to the Adelaide offering for tourism here. Education is a very important industry for South Australia and vital to its future as a clever state in a clever country. We are allocating an extra $1.5 billion to education over the first 3 years of a Beazley Labor government, money which will be essential in rebuilding South Australia's education system, improving its schools, TAFE colleges and universities, and the future for young South Australians. Australia's excellent universities will benefit from a range of initiatives, including an increase in the total number of university places, abolition of upfront fees for Australian undergraduates, and improvements in the HECS system and in student assistance. Well, the package I have outlined here today is our down payment on a vibrant industrial future for South Australia. It will not be delivered without a committed, active government. Without good government, the decline can only continue. The two packages we've produced for Tasmania and here in South Australia are really arresting packages, but we do see them as down payments. The purpose is to, if you like, shake or rattle the cage in terms of drawing the attention of our fellow Australians to what is becoming a substantial problem in national development overall, and that is the affairs, the developments in these two vital regions of Australia, South Australia and Tasmania. They happen to be two of the most habitable parts of the country, and yet habitation or the numbers of people in relative terms, and in some cases, not here, but in Tasmania in absolute terms, that population is declining. This is not an acceptable trend. This is a trend that has to change. Now, I realise always there's a substantial discount on what people say or what politicians say at election time. We are, with all our promises, nailing our flag to the mast. We understand the issues of credibility. We can say these things, and this needs to be understood, we can say these things in this election campaign because we have acted with extraordinary caution in the way in which we've approached the budget surplus, which is there. Our opponents have raided that budget surplus to the tune of $18 billion to pay their tax bribes in order to get people interested in the GST. We have raided it in the taxation sense for purposes of our tax undertakings, not at all. And the reason why we've done that is because we think there are essential tasks confronting the government in relation to public outlays. There are crises in many of our important public services now, in health, in education, in care for the elderly, in childcare. And there are serious problems in our regions, and nowhere more serious in a regional sense than here in South Australia. And so we are able to make this sort of down payment. We are able to work out a strategy. I don't particularly like the South Australian government. I don't like it much at all, if the truth be told. But the truth of the matter is the South Australian government, like the Tasmanian government, cannot carry the burden. They cannot do it. They can talk about it, but they cannot carry it. It has to be a joint effort in which the national government is involved, because this is a question of the national interest. And because it is a question of the national interest, the national government must have a plan. Well, we have a plan. Our opponents do not. And our plan is not simply based on some pie-in-the-sky opportunity that is supposed to be out there. It's hard, fast, rooted firmly in the capacities of this state, the enormous skills base which is here, the substantial scientific capability which is here, the defence industries which are here. These are the basis on which we will assist in the rebuilding of the opportunity here in South Australia. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Kim. Now we're going to take questions. If the procedure is fairly simple, if you can direct your questions straight to Kim Beazley. As I said before, if we could keep them to questions rather than statements. We have two people, Judith and Bob, over the back there who've got microphones. So if we could begin with questions. Thank you.
I can't hear, but anyway.
In your document, Mr. Beazley, you put out that on the Alice Arthur Railway, you said,
Come up here and use this one. Come up here and use this.
I can repeat the questions, mate. It's not a problem.
You just said, it's Phil Curry from the Advertiser.
Yes, sir.
Here, you just said with the Alice Darwin Railway that you'd give up to $300 million for it, but in your document you have, as a result of delays by three coalition governments, its commencement has been delayed. Is it not true to say that it's actually the initiative of a state Liberal and the Northern Territory government and the Howard government that has kicked it off, and they often attack you for your 13 years in government for not actually kicking the project off? So where do you stand on that?
Well, I'm not impressed with the government in Darwin on any of this. Bob Hawke gave them a magnificent opportunity to involve themselves jointly with the Commonwealth for a great deal more resources from the Commonwealth than $100 million. But they, for years and years, said it was a total Commonwealth responsibility and they wouldn't be in it. And I note that the resources that they subsequently spent on the Parliament building there to house 20-odd members of Parliament at full federal salaries, representing constituencies of 3,000 apiece, that the funds which could have well and truly been matched with Bob Hawke's offer back then were not matched. And subsequently, since I've been leader of the Labor Party, because that happens to be one of my primary beliefs, and when you actually become leader of the Labor Party, some of your views resonate a bit more strongly than they did in previous incarnations, it has enabled me to do it. I became convinced, and I won't say all my colleagues were at the time, despite the fact they made that offer to the Northern Territorians, I became convinced we absolutely needed the Darwin to Alice Springs railway line during the Kangaroo 89 exercises, when I looked at the way in which we cluttered the Stuart Highway, merely moving a division north, and then still had to use the sea lanes to the tune of a third of supply of it. That made it a highly vulnerable military commitment, and there was an absolute requirement to get the sort of heavy loads that you can only get out of a railway system. So I've been convinced about it for a long time. I did have hopes that the Northern Territory government back in the 80s would have responded to the Hawke offer. They did not do so, and then only recently became interested in it again jointly with the South Australian government. Well, we have been assured that $100 million will do the trick. We'll see.
I'll just check this is working. Michael Angelakis, I promise we won't tell anyone you ate chicken today.
Mr. Beasley.
He didn't do anything. I haven't had anywhere near as much damage done me as the last time I was with Michael Angelakis. I can tell you that.
Mr. Beasley, Frederick Tobin, Adelaide Institute. Mr. Beasley, you do honour to your father, who was the Minister of Education. And, of course, when you mentioned Dr. Kemp, I have to pull out the card that in 63... I was at Melbourne University and Kemp was running the Liberal Club, while the Labour Party was busy ideologising the whole system and thinking. We were merely drinking and barbecuing. Now, I am part of that tradition who also voted for Malcolm Fraser because he was in our electorate in Victoria. Now, your point about South Australia, offering this to South Australia, you realise South Australia is a state of dissent.
This is getting perilously close to a statement.
Okay.
The question is...
But it's very interesting.
Of course it is. The question is, put your rhetoric aside and get away from the them-us dichotomy and think of one nation, not that one nation, if you wish, but think of the education systems within Australia. And what you have is an ideologized system that does not serve our nation. What are you going to do specifically, for example, to get rid of handicaps such as the Racial Hatred Act that stops us from thinking clearly and freely?
No, you should have cut the question off. Look, I do agree with you on one thing. This is an exceptionally civilised state in the way in which the world is viewed. This is a state with a great liberal tradition, small l, liberal tradition. And it's also a state with a great cultural tradition and a tradition of thinking seriously about national ideology and national ideas. But it's also a state with a superb recognition in the a superb record in the creation of a multicultural society. And that multicultural society has been built on a tradition of mutual respect between different groups here in South Australia as the years have gone by. It's not necessarily always been easy for migrants coming into this nation. And there is a requirement, I believe, to keep a civilised discourse. And sometimes a good law helps that. Sometimes a good law helps that discourse. I've got to say, I have many friends, Australian friends, who are of a non-Caucasian origin, who are of a different racial background to myself. And I've got to tell you that the conversations I've had with them over the last 2 years have been some of the saddest I've ever had. The saddest. And I'm talking here, in one instance, about a person who is in fact a five-generation Australian. Because the Chinese were here well and truly in the 19th century, who speaks with an Australian accent and for the first time has sensed that he's been made to feel his, if you like, Chineseness in the context of his contribution as an Australian or as membership of Australian society. Frankly, a lot of people in Australia have come to feel very uncomfortable over the course of the last 2 years, and that has got to change. And part of the change is electing a government that pursues policies that values all our contribution, all of it. And that is the sort of government I would want to form. We are a government with a marvellous tradition. We are a people with a marvellous tradition of freedom of speech. And we are the freest expressors of opinion, the greatest knockers of tall poppies, the greatest sceptics, express sceptics of political leadership, the quickest to be effective critics. But we have always kept the discourse associated with that civil. And we've always, at least certainly for many, many years, we've valued each other. We need to keep it that way.
Mr. Beasley, Andrew Mayo from the ABC. Just a brief question. Do you feel that in actually creating a special policy for South Australia that there is a risk that South Australia is actually going to feel with Tasmania as if it's a national basket case? And if so, do you feel as if there's any likely to be any resentment towards your party at the next election?
Well, I don't know, but I can tell you this. If the federal government doesn't get on the job immediately and start doing some of these sorts of things, problems will emerge. I mean, really, an election's not much good to anyone, I don't think, unless there is contained within that election a decent statement of national plans, a decent statement of what you're about, an identification of problems and concerns. I think, frankly, that the situation here, as you look at the drift from the state of population, particularly young population, as you look at the problems that are there in industry, you can't any longer just go on turning a blind eye to it or saying it's something that gets dealt with every time South Australia has a state election. It doesn't get dealt with every time South Australia has a state election. It's had a couple of them in recent times and the problem is still there. The problem has not gone away. And yet there is here such a focal point of enormous talent. I wasn't aware of this really until I was Defence Minister and got an encyclopaedic understanding of the capabilities of South Australian industry, to know what loss of young skills from the South Australian community actually really means. There is a base here to build on. If I take a bit of political damage, or more particularly, I suppose, if the poor devils who are running on my behalf here take a bit of political damage on the way through because I identify the problem, well, I guess we'll just have to take some. But no point in ignoring it. No point in ignoring it.
Brad Crouch from the Sunday Mail. Mr. Beasley, the former Federal Labor government successfully and aggressively pursued policies of opening the Australian economy to the world and particularly linking it to Asia. During this campaign, you've been warning of a serious economic downturn looming, and that appears partially because of the Asian crisis. Will a future Federal Labor government continue to pursue economic integration with Asia ahead of other regions?
Well, we also, when we pursued that strategy, and most of how you characterise our position is correct, so I'm not walking back from that, but how you characterised our strategy does need amplification. I mean, the government which was cracking open new markets in Africa, in South America, trying to redo the opportunity in Eastern Europe after the collapse of the communist empire, and to start to expand ourselves beyond simply the base in the UK in terms of relationship with Europe. It was we who did all that. People didn't notice it because the concentration on our initiatives in the region around us was so intense, but we were not neglecting what was going on elsewhere, and just as well, because there's been a reasonable surge in the export performance elsewhere, but of course we're now starting to hit, if you like, ceilings as far as that is concerned, as more and more people rush to compete in those areas too. There have been some good export figures in those areas. People who know anything about, as you would, about the way in which trade patterns move, they don't change overnight. Trade patterns take a long time to change, and so the relative success that we've enjoyed there in other regions for the last year or two has been a product of very solid work done over the best part of a decade. And people like Bob McMullen and Joe Dawkins and the rest of it, who are our trade ministers, used to spend an awful lot of time not in Asia but elsewhere. But despite the difficulties in the region around us, it is still a good region to have that relationship with. Now, while I don't think the problem's going to go away any time in the next couple of years, in the next 5 to 10 years it will. And the fact that and that vibrant growth pattern will resume. The point is, where do we stand now? How do we deal with the problem immediately? How do we position ourselves correctly? If this election were being held 12 months from now, we would not be discussing tax, frankly. Certainly not in the context of a GST. Nobody would go around in the sort of economic climate that we are going to contemplate 12 months from now advocating a tax on jobs, a tax on service industries. You'd be run out of town on a rail. The government has its one opportunity to have some saliency for its view now. It is not a view that would stand up for a second 12 months from now. What an election 12 months from now would be about is this sort of thing. Interventionist, activist government. But a government of partnership, not directing from the high points of the economy, partnership, and partnership with business. Business is going to sorely need governments with that sort of attitude 12 months or so from now.
Mr. Beasley, Steve Gawler speaking primarily as a private individual, I guess. I'd appreciate your comment on two issues. Firstly, thank you for your package. It certainly offers a lot of hope and promise for South Australia. It seems to me that, particularly watching the debate last Sunday night, that one of the Achilles heels of the Labor Party is likely to be the employment or unemployment issue, and it would seem to me that that's probably unfortunate, but the debate seems to be becoming confused between unemployment rates and participation rates.
Yeah.
And the argument certainly in 96 from the Labor government was hinging around a fairly impressive success record in having increased participation rates. Mm. I'd be interested in your comments as to how you're hoping to tackle that in the next couple of weeks to give an accurate picture. And secondly, on a fairly minor matter, the proposal to spend $12 million to preserve and upgrade the Torrens Parade Ground seems to me like a fairly trivial strategy compared to the mega issues that we're facing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, every leader of the Labor Party is entitled to one obsession. Mine happens to be military history, so there you are. But I also think that it will be a useful. If you look at the way in which the Australian War Memorial operates, and you may have been there, but if you do, if you know, as they usually have once or twice a year a display of militaria that is not on display from their warehouses, you'll know there's an enormous amount of highly interesting material that is available for situation somewhere else, and I think to have an annex here, you would find it a tourism attraction which that many have not even comprehended its value to this point of time. There is an enormous fascination out there in the general community, particularly actually for domestic tourism as much as international tourism. There is an enormous fascination out there for Australia's history, military history. And I think, though it looks small, and not to be compared necessarily with 800 million on a couple of submarines or something like that, but nevertheless, it is something that I think that would become treasured here. On your other point, you make an interesting point. We used to, during the course of the 1980s, when we made undertakings about jobs, we used to make those undertakings in the context of, well, in the next term we'll create 500,000 jobs. That's what we used to say, or we'll see 500,000 jobs created. That will be our objective. We never missed one of those targets whenever we set. We didn't set them every election, but we set them in most. And we never missed one of those targets. I remember being mocked in the 93 election when we talked about 500,000. We had 650,000 that was created from that point. And we did not concentrate on what you refer to as participation rates, but that's a sort of economic jargon. It's basically people who want to join the workforce. It's putting it simply, people who want to join the workforce. The reason we didn't concentrate on that is that we were conscious of the fact that we were presiding over the gender revolution in Australian participation, in our revolution which occurred in Europe and the United States in the 1960s and 70s to a very considerable extent, and started to occur in Australia in the 1970s and went through to the 1980s. If you want an example of what that caused, is if you were a... If we'd had John Howard's participation rates, or the number of people wanting to work, a percentage of the workforce wanting to work, when we left office in 1996, the unemployment level in Australia would have been 4%. That's what the unemployment level would have been. And at the height of the recession, the unemployment rate would have been 7%, not 11%. When we reflect with his participation rates, John Howard had 11%. We can reflect on how easy a target he experienced when he was Treasurer compared with the struggle that we had. But the attitudes and views of the community have changed. But as they've changed, so too have the requirements or the burdens on the system. The rate of growth in the Australian market has declined. That surge that we've experienced of people wanting to be participants has begun to abate. Now, when first myself and then big time Simon started to look at the working nation and started to make our calculations that we could hit a particular level of employment or level of unemployment in the community, it was based on a very thorough understanding of the labour market. We went through a very considerable analysis back in 94, and we changed the way in which we did targets, because we then thought we had some control on where it is that we could take things. We weren't any longer getting a growing like topsy labour market. So we then said that within two terms, effectively, that's not how we put it, but what it effectively meant was within two terms we could achieve that 5% level. And then we had 3 years of Liberal government. But our intention is to resume the march once that's over.
Matthew Abraham from the Adelaide Bureau of the Australian newspaper.
Mr. Beasley, I don't want to keep you from your non-GST Barney banana, which we're hoeing into here.
Right. So right.
Just following you around and listening to you on television and watching you today, you are a sort of an old-fashioned sort of guy, an old-fashioned sort of politician. I mean that in a nice way. But short of going back to the Mavis Bramston show and endless reruns of the Sullivans, Tony Blair promised us new Labor, and you seem to be promising old Labor and interventionist Labor. And is there any solution in that for an economy which you say will be facing crisis?
Well, we haven't done bad in crises in the past, the Labor Party. I'd talk about being today's Labor. Actually, there are substantial differences here. If you look at Labor Party history and what we are doing. What we are doing is contemporary. You know, don't forget the fact that working nation, which for ideological reasons was pulled apart by our political opponents, was seen as exemplary in Europe and other nations wanting to change to adapt to the impact of a global economy, and in particular the needs to skill and reskill society. If we were actually old Labour, we would only be talking about a skill for life. In fact, our education plans and our employment plans are based on the notion of skilling and reskilling. We don't talk about jobs for life, we talk about employment for life. They are two different things. And so the education programs that we are putting forward, I think, are very much in the light of contemporary thinking about how you tackle unemployment problems and how you tackle your participation in an economy which is effectively globalised. I guess old Labour would be talking about nationalisation, it would be talking about controlling the commanding heights of the economy. Today's Labour talks about interventionist government in the context of reciprocal obligation. There are obligations on the unemployed to take up the opportunities that government offers them to skill themselves. There are obligations on industry to understand that they need a bit of government help to return for that good performances in relation to investment. When Simon's the industry minister-to-be is talking about something like 16 strategic action plans which have elements slotted into them of some form of government assistance or promises of it, and that drives a countervailing response from industry. I actually think that I do look like you you do characterise. I am unacquainted with gyms, and people have compared my girth and measurements to other prime ministers of both political persuasions, but I think you'd find in the sorts of strategies that we're putting forward, they're actually strategies for interventionist governments and for contemporary interventionist governments. I would argue, in fact, that we are more attuned with the needs of the next century than our political opponents. If you look at the inwardness of John Howard's policies, you've got a GST, which is a classic European tax from the era when people took the view that jobs would go on growing forever. Who cares? Tax jobs then. That's a good idea. You'll get some money from it if you tax jobs. He's talking about privatising Telstra when he knows, or ought to know, that the entirety of the Australian electronics industry depends on a capacity to access Telstra's purchasing policies. And the moment it gets privatised and the normal Australian directors' rules apply, what will happen is those directors will be saying, come on, spin off the back of the orders, of the marginally priced orders of the foreign Telstras that are now part of the ownership structure. And if you don't do that, you're going to be oppressing the interests of the minority shareholders here, which will mean enormous damage to the Australian electronics industry, which has become one of our export leaders. But that's his position. It's a real 1980s liberal stuff, that one. And then he wants a second wave of industrial relations. Well, look, if you don't have a cooperative model of industrial relations, you don't have a sense of security in the community, you don't have a consumer confidence, you don't have decent democratic treatment of people, you've got 19th century masters and servants stuff. And that is basically what they're stuck with. Masters, how to replicate at the end of the century the Masters and Servants Act. And then the other positions of Mr Howard are basically that unemployment takes care of itself. Well, it doesn't. It doesn't take care of itself. It never has in any country. And that includes the United States. The greatest industry policy pursued by any nation on earth in the last 20 years is called the US defence budget.
Another question from... I'm sorry, David, you go first.
Yeah, Mr Beasley. David Penberthy from the Adelaide Advertiser. One thing that you failed to mention at all today is the question of state debt, which still remains the biggest problem for South Australia. Would you concede that our debt is largely Labor's fault through John Bannon's mismanagement of the state bank? And in addition to that, should ETSA be sold to cut that debt?
Well, The South Australian people, like the Tasmanian people, have to make up their own minds on what it is that they propose to sell in relation to their government. I would say that our view would be, from the national level, that that is a matter for the South Australians to determine, as it was a matter for the Tasmanians to determine, but that it is never wise, to my mind, to privatise things with a monopoly characteristic. That is my view. Now, that's as a general view, that if something is of a monopoly characteristic that serves everybody and that there are standards issues involved, then somebody has to be held accountable for it, and it's a lot easier to hold a government accountable than it is to hold a private entity accountable. That's a general proposition. One of the problems we had when we were in office was that we articulated the fact that we took the view that nothing was immutable in the government sector, but at the same time we did not have a view that nothing ought to be there. And there's a difference between that and the propositions that have been put up by our opponents. And when we come down to something with monopoly characteristics, when we come down to something that is central to the economy of a state or nation, in the case of Telstra, when we come down to something that is central to industry, when we come down to something that is making money and not a charge on the budget, when you have all those things added in, from recollection, to a degree somewhat greater than that which I announced in Tasmania the other day. So my focus has been, unlike that package that I announced in Tasmania, my focus here has been very heavily on building on known South Australian strengths in scientific and industrial endeavour and in tourism. That's been our focus for this package. While we have packages for both South Australia and Tasmania, they don't actually look the same. And the reason why they don't look the same is that the problems and the strengths are different in both cases.
Another one from the Sunday Mail table over here.
Mr. Beasley, Craig Clark from the Sunday Mail. You set a national job target of 5%. What target do you believe you can achieve in South Australia, given we're at 10.4% now?
Well, let us work on one national target. Obviously, I mean, the rising tide raises all boats. And if you've got a government driving towards that sort of target that set its cap for it and wants to achieve it, then, of course, all parts of the economy will benefit from that. We haven't set a specific state-by-state target, and it would be very difficult to do that without a state-by-state strategy. But our intention would be to see a very substantial improvement here in the period of time that that we had set ourselves that 5% target. But we won't be announcing individual state targets. All we're going to be trying to do is to make sure that everybody improves. Sorry? Oh, yes, certainly it's to improve the job prospects of South Australia. That's absolutely the case. But I wouldn't make a prediction on levels of employment here. I would say what we're striving for on a national basis, and that would probably produce a substantial improvement here, and it would produce and these policies would assist that. But these policies weren't going to be accompanied with a specific employment target related to South Australia.
Mr. President, there's a question over here that I don't think the Leader will have had on the campaign trail to date. He may choose not to answer on the basis they can't vote for him, but I think he might choose to answer it.
Daniel Cooper from ABC Education Television.
Oh, right.
I work for a program called Behind the News. The target audience is 12 to 13-year-olds. So if you could sort of knock the jargon back a few levels.
Thank you. I think I've been
no
remarkably jargon-free.
Okay,
no participation rates. Good.
Do young people in Australia have a right to work?
Look, I think everybody in Australia has a right to work. I think there's no two ways about that. I mean, people sometimes ask me for a definition of full employment. My definition of full employment is that everybody who wants to work is working. That's my definition of full employment. And I do think that that young people have a right to work. I do think that young people, we need to be very, very careful about how we define young people too. I, for example, don't regard people between 18 and 21 as young people. I regard them as adults. And that has consequences. But I do regard a person of the age of 12 as a young person. That is the case. And while obviously there's not the necessity for somebody of that age to work, and what I'd rather that somebody of that age to be doing would be to be properly ensconced in school and getting the benefit of a very good education, and that if they were to go into the workforce that they would not in any way, shape or form be exploited. I used to work on friends and Relly's farms from the age of about 12 on to earn a quid, so I can't really complain if somebody feels they ought to do it.
Mr. Beasley, Miles Kemp from the Advertiser. I think I could preempt your answer to this question with a fairly strong statement against One Nation, but I'd like to ask to take you back to that 12-month period after Pauline Hanson's maiden speech and ask you, are you happy with your strategy not to take her on, not to engage her in the debate, particularly the race debate, given that you're now expecting or in the public polling are getting a far better preference flow from One Nation than you would otherwise have expected?
We've got a completely rotten preference flow from One Nation to... But I don't know where this 12-month hiatus is supposed to come from. I know we used to have a few people out there saying, you know, what are you saying about it? If you were in the Canberra Press Gallery, you got a telephone book every time you wrote something like that. Of all the statements on my doorstops that nobody ever bothered to print and that nobody ever bothered to carry. It used to... I don't complain about the press. So I think the press does an excellent job. But geez, it used to cheese me off when I was first leader of the opposition. I never got a run anywhere. And so when I'd come out of Canberra to various parts of the country, what I would find would be people say, well, I haven't just said anything about Pauline Hanson. I'd say, well, it would be very nice if somebody would report me. And those telephone books would go around. We uniquely in the Labor Party understood the threat here immediately. Uniquely. And when she formed her political party, we immediately moved for a preference direction. Now, she draws her support from all sides of politics. There's no doubt about that. And she draws it for various reasons, some of which is deep dissatisfaction with the major political parties in this country. And part of that, and one of the things I've come to realise as a political leader, that if I want to make my own personal contribution to ensuring our nation stays whole, then there is a special task on me to keep credibility. And that is something which is very much a challenge and to the forefront of my thinking as I put the various election undertakings down that I do. But we never balked at the so-called M word. In fact, I can recollect turning up here at a gathering of ethnic news services or media conferences shortly after one of her earliest speeches. And I understand some of my political opponents turned up when there was a ban on using the word multicultural, but they were allowed to use the word diverse, but not multicultural. I spent a considerable amount of time using the word multicultural. So we have always stood on that issue. We've not always received attention.
I think we've got time for one more question.
Anne Timney Jenkin, freelance writer. Mr. Beasley, I'd like to ask you a tax question. Mm-hmm. Something that doesn't seem to have been addressed in this election campaign, and that's the question of the tax-free threshold. Mm. Once upon a time, this was indexed, but it's remained at $5,400 for many years now, and surely that's ludicrously low. It seems to me that one way of putting more money in the pockets of the very poor, people in the poverty traps, would be to say that no one who earns less than, say, $10,000 has to pay any tax at all.
That's about what happens with our tax package. I think this is one of the disappointing features of the argument so far on tax, is nobody has looked at how interesting our proposition is in regard to tax credits. I do point out from student to students from time to time that with the operation of the tax credit, until they get to about $9,400, they pay no tax at all. Admittedly, they get it back in a credit in the first instance, but that is the practical effect of it. We tried to get away from, in the way in which we did our tax package, from the issues of thresholds and margins. And because when you go to thresholds and margins, there is nothing you can do other than benefit the highest income earners in the community. And your tax changes will automatically be skewed upwards. The only new thing that either the Labor Party or the Liberal Party offers in this election is the Labor Party's idea of tax credits. The GST has got all those European antecedents I talked about. The benefits that we put forward on development allowances, infrastructure bonds, R&D tax concessions, the whole panoply of business assistance that we're putting forward, while I think it's necessary to do it, I don't actually think that we can claim authorship of it. These things have been done before, both by Labor governments and governments of other political persuasions. Nobody has attempted to develop before a comprehensive set of tax credit arrangements which focus in on middle-income Australia and don't send the tax benefits in holus bolus up the line. So the threshold for a low-income earner, really, on paying tax by our tax credit system has been shifted up to about a bit over $9,000. That's the effective that's the reality of it. It's not for somebody earning $60,000, but it is for somebody earning up to $10,000. And you can read that up the line. You know, I don't think people have really cottoned on to the life-transforming situation, of the what would happen to families on incomes of about $30,000 to $40,000. The tax credit would produce $3,000 to $4,000 in the hand to them. See, the tax credit operates on the basis that you get effectively 10 cents for every dollar that you earn, as a up to particular income levels, as a credit, so that when you get your tax bill at the end of the year, that you will in fact have that offset by the credit that will be paid to you. Oddly enough, if you got earned up to the threshold, you'd actually get a tax benefit. So it operates as more than a rebate. So if you're in a family situation and you're getting that tax credit and you earn $5,000, but no more, you'd get no tax rebate because you wouldn't be paying tax. You'd get a tax credit of several hundred dollars as a result of the operation of the system. You get a fact tax payment. So, yes, I do agree with you that there's a lot of people who haven't fully comprehended it, but it does actually deal with the problem you're talking about for low-income earners.
Okay, we've got just one more.
Mr. President, just to prove to the Leader of the Opposition that we aren't always terribly serious here at the South Australian Press Club, I thought I might remind you of a cartoon by Larry Pickering that was run in the Australian newspaper when I was assistant editor of that paper many years ago, that showed, as I recall it, Malcolm Fraser lying in bed with Gough Whitlam, and Malcolm was saying, "I think I feel an election coming on." My question, Leader, is will things like this make it harder to raise the GST to 10%.
Oh, dear me. Well, not if it's provided by prescription, but if it's not on the PBS, it will be taxed with the GST.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for the questions. Mr. Beasley, thank you very much for your time in answering them. I would ask everybody to acknowledge our guest speaker. And And just before we go, it is a tradition of the South Australian Press Club to actually present the guest speaker with a small gift. Even though we're in the middle of an election campaign, we propose to do this. It's in a plain brown wrapper. And in case anybody is there's any concern about what's actually in it, this is arguably one of those best wines. Okay. Sue?
Right. Well, I've got your attention and before you all start talking. We'll draw the raffle, so get your tickets out. Gillian Attrill, head of ABC News, come on up and draw the raffle for us. Okay, have you got your ticket? This is Gillian Attrill, head of ABC News, for those of you who don't know Jill. The first prize we have is the Beazley biography by Peter Fitzsimmons, signed by Kim Beazley. And who is it?
Sadly, it's won by a West Australian, Karen Middleton.
Karen, where are you? Come on down, Karen, and we'll give you your book.
This is probably about your third copy, isn't it, Karen? Mm-hmm.
And for another copy of the book we have, Jill.
There you go. Well done. F. Bedford. Francis Bedford. Member for Florey.
Is the member for Florey here? She's gone out. Somebody come and collect that book on her behalf, please. And thanks to Telstra, a gold pen and pencil set and a business card holder.
It's Karen Hannon.
Karen Hannon.
Just over there, just grab the pen and pencil set.
I might also mention that if you'd like to purchase a copy of the book, the Beazley biography, the ladies are selling it over in the corner, and today it's $35. They have some signed by Kim Beazley. Kim signed them just as he came in here today. Normally $39.95. It's $35 for you today if you'd like to go and get a copy over in the corner. Right, where are we up to?
I gave that lady two things. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Right, we now have from 5AA a pack of six CDs of current artists. Who do we have, Jill?
We have Steve Harrison. From Clare.
Steve Harrison from Clare. Where are you, Steve? And Alan Rogers, please come up here. Alan is from Ragoni's Bistro and also from the Rock Lobster, who kindly makes available these $50 vouchers every Press Club luncheon. Jill from Ragoni's Bistro. Ragoni's Bistro in Lee Street, that wonderful Italian restaurant. A $50 voucher, and Alan's got it here.
And it goes to Mr. Kelton from the Advertiser.
Mr. Kelton from the Advertiser. And from the Rock Lobster, thanks to Alan, the Rock Lobster in Googer Street, where you can enjoy some wonderful seafood.
It's Mr. Kelton again. We have to write.
No, no, he's not getting that one. No.
No. Sorry. Back in your box, Greg.
Well, it just goes to show he bought more than one ticket. Right, a carton of Southwark Premium from SA Brewing.
Ian Hunter.
We have two bottles of red wine, a nice Peter Lehman Shiraz and a Hardy's Insignia. And for the wine, Jill?
Yeah. Are we getting two?
Just one.
Is it C. Freeman? C. Freeman?
C80, an orange ticket. C. Freeman, it looks like. C80, an orange ticket. Who's got it? Where are you? Oh, here we come. And for two tickets to the Royal Adelaide Wine Show, which happens on October the 9th. Now make sure you get along to this, because I'm sure it'll be fantastic. It's called The Taste of the Best. Francine O'Connor has given us two tickets.
Liz Calloway.
Liz Calloway. Good on you, Liz. And we have another two tickets as well. Another two tickets to the Adelaide Wine Show on October the 9th.
And it's Joe Canizzaro.
Joe Canizzaro. Thank you very much. Don't forget the books are on sale over in the corner for $35, the Beasley biography, signed by Kim Beasley. And also on October the 6th, Ray Martin at the Hindley Park Royal. On October the 23rd, Andy Thomas, the astronaut at the Stanford Grand. Thank you for your attendance today.
Thanks, George.